Welcome everyone to another episode of the Damage Report. I'm John Adirola, mainly solo today, although we not only have a big, you know, huge list of different news topics we're going to get to, we do have two guests joining us a little bit later on in the day. So you might have noticed, if you've been on political Twitter over the past couple of days, Tucker Carlson and his show on Fox News have been under the gun for some of the disgusting things he's said on immigration over the past few days. Some of his sponsors have actually dropped out as a result of the social media firestorm. In the next block, actually, we're going to have Jordan Ewell on, progressive activist who led that effort to strip away some of his sponsors. So we're going to find out how exactly they accomplished that and what's different about this particular instance of the xenophobic views of Tucker Carlson a little bit later on. The second guest, one you're probably familiar with, Brett Ehrlich, is going to be joining us briefly at the close of the show to talk about dancing. Can it actually be patented or copywritten? Can you actually protect a dance that if somebody else uses it, do you deserve some money? We'll talk about that in the context of the very popular video game Fortnite at the very close of the show. But along the way, we've got so much to talk about. Breaking news on the Trump Foundation. We've got breaking news on Michael Flynn and his sentencing as well. He is literally in the courtroom right now as we're filming this. And later on, the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about a couple of very important trends in politics that have developed since the midterm elections. So the discussion about the Green New Deal. How convincing has it been to the American public who've been watching this? We've got new numbers on that. And also Donald Trump. Has he learned his lesson from the midterms? Can he learn his lesson? And if he doesn't, how significant will it be for his chances in 2020? We'll be breaking down those as well. Lots to get to. Let's jump in with some of the breaking news. I just want to mention briefly on Michael Flynn. We've been watching as we've been producing the show this morning to see if he would actually be sentenced, because there were a couple of reasons to think that he would get a light or no sentence, and then some new developments that made it seem as if perhaps he would be going to jail for a while. So in advance of today's sentencing, or, you know, it looked like there was going to be a sentencing. By the way, not bad hair on that old man. There had been the sentencing memo, and it looked like Mueller was quite happy with the performance of Michael Flynn in the apparently 19 different interviews he sat down for over almost the last 2 years, and suggested that perhaps he should serve no time whatsoever, that he had cooperated a great deal. Now, understand the background, you had Donald Trump and right-wing media personalities pushing this idea that he had been put in a perjury trap, or he had been tricked into lying. I don't understand how that would work. Nobody seems to understand how that would work. The term perjury trap is an insult to literally every person who has to hear it. But that's what they've been saying. And then you get to today's sentencing hearing where Michael Flynn goes in and the judge goes off saying that his actions in the White House, effectively working for foreign countries, potentially is treasonous, that it's a repudiation of everything that the flag stands for, and that Michael Flynn, as a former member, very high-ranking member of the military, should know that more than anyone. And so I can't say for sure if that's why his defense decided, you know what, this sentencing thing, let's not actually go through with that today. But it is possible that the rumblings of possible treason led him to second guess that. Now, bear in mind that the special counsel's office said there is no reason in their view to believe that what he did was treasonous. And again, they seem to be very happy with the cooperation he's provided. But something, either today or in the past week or so, has spooked Michael Flynn and his defense team. And so they have pushed for sentencing to be pushed back for quite a while, actually. It looks like at this point, we're going to have to wait till March to actually know. And the reason is that they are now saying, well, you know, there's a little bit more cooperating we can do. And I honestly can't say what that could possibly be. And if there is something, if it turns out that over the first 19 interviews, there's one last juicy morsel that they've been holding on to, I guess as part of a cooperation agreement, that would be worth some sort of leniency from the special counsel's office or the prosecutor or the judge or whatever. But I would be pretty frustrated if I were them, that you had been strung along for almost 2 years by someone with inside information and access to what was actually going on, that made you wait this long, that made you literally take him to court again to get him to finally cooperate. That would be frustrating. But we're going to have to wait until at least March, it turns out, to actually find out what's going to happen with him. And that also provides, by the way, more time for right-wing pundits to interfere, for Donald Trump to float the possibility of a pardon, to put pressure on Michael Flynn not to cooperate. All of that continues. With that said, though, we do have another scandal to get into. Gigantic breaking news on the Trump Foundation. It's not a Trump Foundation anymore. It doesn't exist. It is going to be dissolved. So there have been ongoing scandals for more than a year now. In fact, if you went to the Trump Foundation entry on Wikipedia, to get to the actual information on the origin of it, you have to scroll through far more than a dozen different lines of concern about ethical problems, laws being broken, and all of that. So I was very excited to find out on the Washington Post today, President Trump has agreed to shut down his personal charity and give away its remaining money amid allegations that he used the foundation for his personal and political benefit. That was announced by the New York Attorney General, Barbara Underwood, who also accompanied that announcement with a couple of tweets. She said they've secured a stipulation requiring it to dissolve. They're going to be reviewing that dissolving to make sure that they actually do give away the money to legitimate charities. Says that the foundation functioned as little more than a checkbook to serve Mr. Trump's interests. Our lawsuit remains ongoing, and that is the interesting part. She has a second tweet. This is an important victory for the rule of law. There's one set of rules for everyone. We'll continue to move our suit forward to ensure that the Trump Foundation and its directors are held accountable for their clear and repeated violations of state and federal law. So you might think, well, if it's being dissolved, if the money is being given away, then isn't that mission accomplished? What more do you need to do? Well, if they were actually defrauding people, then there are damages that likely might need to be paid out. And so Underwood said that the foundation's remaining $1.75 million will be distributed to other charities, but that that will not take care of their required, I guess, redress to those that they have defrauded. And I don't know what number that could go up to. The foundation in the best of times had something like $3 million on hand. So it's unlikely that the damages they would have to pay out would be far more than that. But it is still something. And for a guy like Donald Trump, that is going to hurt. Now, what is it about the Trump Foundation that made it such a locus of scandals and ethics concerns and all of that? Well, it's been around for a long time, and through the multiple decades that it's existed, it has done very little in the way of actual charitable giving. It seems like it has been set up as some sort of sham, quasi-shell foundation to be used for the personal expenses of Donald Trump, the legal expenses of Donald Trump and his family, and as a convenient way to make it seem as if he's doing donations that he is in fact not doing. So let's start with that last point. The real estate mogul used other people's donations to build up the foundation's assets. And the way that that worked is people like Vince and Linda McMahon, other Republicans, things like that, would provide large amounts of money as donations to the Trump Foundation. The Trump Foundation would then give away the money under their name. So in the end, it looks like they're giving the money away when really, at best, this is being fairer than you should be. They're sort of curating donations, kind of. I mean, it begs the question why Vince and Linda McMahon, you know, the billionaires that they are, wouldn't simply give the money directly to those charities themselves. And I'm sure that they do that as well. It seems like, I think a reasonable person would say, if you're going to put the money through the Trump Foundation along the way, sort of charitable money laundering, it's because you expect to get something out of it. The Trump Foundation by itself isn't doing anything special with the money. They're giving it to places that you could give it to yourself. So why is it that you would want Donald Trump to get credit for the giving that you're actually doing the giving of? I don't know for sure. It's been around for a long time. It could have been wrapped up in any number of different concerns specific to New York, to potential political aspirations later on in life. Considering the length of it, I think that that's a little bit less likely. I mean, it's been around for so long. Although he does periodically talk about running for president. This is going back to the 90s, actually. At this point, the ongoing investigation hopefully will shed some light on that. But let's talk about some of the concerns about the actual spending. And here we're going to go from the largest donations to the smallest donations and show you how he has been able to, across the entire spectrum of donation, be a complete and utter fraud. So the largest donation that they ever gave, that was $264,000 to the Central Park Conservancy in 1989, was used to restore a fountain outside Trump's Plaza Hotel. So the biggest gift they ever gave was, first of all, decades and decades ago, even though he would lead you to believe that he's getting richer over time, and it was used to make a fountain look nicer outside of his hotel. So that as you're walking in, you're like, hey, nice fountain. I guess that that's charitable giving for the birds that use the fountain. I don't think it's benefiting that many people, especially considering that those are not exactly cheap places to stay. Maybe if it was like subsidizing hotel rooms for poor people, that would be nicer, but it didn't go in that direction. So that's the biggest one. The smallest donation was $7. That was given to the Boy Scouts back in 1989. And it also matched the amount required to enroll a boy in the Scouts the year that his son, Donald Trump Jr., was 11. So they gave 7 buckaroos so that Don Jr. could be a Boy Scout. Now, think about that. Now, this is a long time ago, but you would be led to believe that Donald Trump was at least a millionaire, if not a billionaire at that time. And rather than spend his own $7, they donated it from their foundation. $7. That is absurd. They're shocking frauds. It makes me remember a story from back originally in the 80s. There was, I forget the name of it. I think it might have been Vulture or something like that. But there was a newspaper in the New York area, and it would continually troll Donald Trump. And one of the things they would do was they would send him really small checks, like checks for 2 cents or 5 cents or 10 cents, and see if he would cash them. They started with bigger amounts, and they made it smaller and smaller to see what is the threshold that this supposed billionaire will not go to the bank for. And they couldn't find it. They got down to a couple of pennies, and he still signed off on the check. $7. $7. And if that doesn't prove that this was never really a foundation, that it was just for the benefit of him, bear in mind that the Attorney General's investigation turned up evidence that Boy Scout Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, and Ivanka Trump, all listed as officers on the charity, had never held a board meeting. The board hadn't met since 1999, and Alan Weisselberg, the official treasurer, said he wasn't aware that he was on the board at all. So the entire thing was a sham. It had no formal organization. It had no mission to actually accomplish any sort of charitable goal. It was there to benefit Donald Trump. We've talked before about this, so I won't go into detail. But one of the worst instances was a $25,000 donation given to Pam Bondi in Florida, apparently around the exact time that she was considering an investigation into some of his other fraudulent activities. Now, she was up for re-election at this point. She needed support, so he donated money to a group that was supporting her re-election. And suddenly, totally coincidentally, she decided not to investigate some of the claims of fraud in another one of the areas of his business. So not only do you have benefiting his businesses and getting his boy into the Boy Scouts, you also have pay for play coming from wealthy donors for the benefit of Donald Trump. And by the way, now that it is being dissolved, it does make me remember one big line of Donald Trump reasoning over the past few years. And that was about one of the reasons you should be really concerned about Hillary Clinton. And that was how sketchy the Clinton Foundation was. He tweeted back in August 2016, "When will we see stories from CNN on Clinton Foundation corruption and Hillary's pay for play at State Department?" Well, now his foundation doesn't even exist because of pervasive concerns about ethics violations and possibly violating the law as well. A little bit of cosmic irony for you. With that said, we are going to take a break. When we come back, progressive activist Jordan Yule is going to be joining us. He has had Tucker Carlson in his sights over the past few days and has notched a number of wins. We'll break those down after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Tucker Carlson's anti-immigrant rhetoric has been so bad over the past few years that at this point, it's really hard for him to say anything that stands out or really shocks you. So much has been normalized. And yet he found a way over the past few days to say something truly vile. Here it is.
this. We have a moral obligation to admit the world's poor, they tell us, even if it makes our own country poorer and dirtier and more divided. Huddled masses yearning to breathe free? Nope. Cynical shakedown artists who've been watching too much CNN.
Tucker Carlson is brought to you by Pacific Life, protecting generations of families for 150 years. That's the power of Pacific.
They make our country dirtier, specifically dirtier. That is disgusting. It bothered a lot of people. And when you combine that with the advertisement at the end, perhaps an opportunity to do something about it. And that is where our next guest comes in, progressive activist Jordan Yule. Welcome to the show.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. So you saw that and you decided to actually take action. So what did you do?
I saw the clip. My friend Andrew Lawrence at Media Matters pointed out the juxtaposition between the comment and the Pacific Life advertisement. So I put them together in a video, tweeted it out, saw it was gaining traction, and then asked Pacific Life, just, hey, how do you feel about this? Your ad immediately follows this reprehensible segment. I didn't expect much of it. I mean, this was like the main, like one of the main banner advertisements on Tucker Carlson. So this is an expensive ad placement. They run that ad frequently, if not every single night. And they responded. They said, you know what? No, we actually don't stand by that language that flies in the face of our company values. We're going to stop advertising on Tucker Carlson's show. And that kind of kicked off this wave this week.
Yeah, I saw that a lot of people were retweeting your comment, regular people on Twitter, activists, and also celebrities as well. So who has been joining you in pressuring these various and the growing list of advertisers from Tucker Carlson's show?
So yeah, it's the catalyst of every like campaign like this is a coalition, right? So this is people driven. This is anyone can get involved. This is a group effort. Sleeping Giants has been like just so valuable to helping forward this effort. This is something that they have really mastered, a technique that they've like really taken to the forefront. Media Matters has been great. Races in Texas, the immigration advocacy group. George Takei has tweeted about it. Judd Apatow has really lended his voice to the effort as well. So a lot of folks from big to small, this is a group, a grassroots effort that has just kind of like swept Twitter.
So let's talk. You got Pacific Life. So who else has actually pulled their advertising so far?
Indeed, the job hunting site Bowflex, SmileDirect, NerdWallet. Those are the ones that pulled before yesterday. And then last night, he doubled down on the comment. Mm-hmm. He played the clip again, said it's true. He said the left was trying to silence him. And then in response to that, Ancestry, Voya, Land Rover, and Minted also pulled their ads. There's a few others that in response that have said that they're going to reevaluate the relationship without saying either way how they've decided, but more and more sponsors are either considering pulling out or are in the process of pulling out.
I'm shocked to find that Bowflex is an advertiser on Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, a pretty frequent one too. I was surprised that they were still around.
So I'm curious then, who are the holdouts? Which companies so far are saying, you know what, nope, we're fine with this. We're not going to change our relationship with them.
So AstraZeneca, the pharmaceutical company, John Deere, a few folks like that. I can't remember the rest off the top of my head for who have said that they're going to actively stay. But the ones that we're not hearing anything from are some of his most frequent advertisers, like 23andMe has run quite possibly more ads than any other company over the past several weeks. Mm-hmm. Nothing. We have not heard anything. But their competitor Ancestry pulled out. So when you have 23andMe, which is like a kind of a go-to holiday gift, at the forefront of a consumer boycott, I don't know how sound of a business decision that is. So I would encourage them to reconsider associating with Tucker.
I just want to briefly mention, I love the fact that this guy who is, he's flirted more and more with, you know, white nationalist and white supremacist rhetoric. That obviously this idea that you know, genetics drives like all this stuff, has both Ancestry and 23andMe up until recently advertising on the show, apparently believing that their audience is going to be really concerned about genetic purity and testing. That's,
you know,
interesting.
You weren't the first person to find that ironic. I'm a little I'm a little reluctant to explicitly say that's why they're advertising, but it does look a little suspicious.
So I want to ask you, as I pointed out in my intro, it's not like Tucker Carlson hasn't said horrendous things before. I mean, he's had guests on who've pushed the book Camp of the Saints and other sorts of classically racist things like that. What is it about this incident that you think helped to finally cause some of these advertisers to drop out?
So I think this kind of veers away from just a traditional free speech defense. Like, I'm not going to agree with pretty much anybody on Fox arguing regarding immigration policies. But this transcended that. This wasn't just like, hey, we need to do X, Y, and Z in regards to the asylum program or the wall. This was like explicitly dehumanizing and xenophobic language. This wasn't, hey, we need to cap it at X amount of people. This was, they make us dirtier and poorer. That is horrifying white nationalist rhetoric that has been championed by the likes of like Andrew Anglin, who runs the Daily Stormer, the neo-Nazi. This is stuff that David Duke is cheering on and Richard Spencer is heralding. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the kind of language that he used was. Like, this isn't just, hey, we need to limit the amount of people that come from Nicaragua.
Yeah,
this was race-based, this was class-based, it has no place on TV.
And I want to ask you, just because I know from following you on Twitter that you keep tabs, like Media Matters does, on these individuals. I generally, aside from, you know, news reporting and Media Matters, things like that, I don't generally consume Tucker Carlson's content. But over time, is my sort of anecdotal experience is correct? Is he getting worse in this area, more explicit in his racism or appeal to white nationalists?
It sure seems that way. I mean, if you think back to when he was on Crossfire, this wasn't language that he frequently trotted out. This seems to be kind of a new and bold push. He seems to be emboldened by it. Fox doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. And advertisers, the ones that are remaining, are continuing to fund and provide a platform and a megaphone for this language.
Yeah.
So unless he faces some sort of repercussions, this is only going to continue and it's only going to get worse.
I have one last question for you. So I know that you said he doubled down recently. You know, that's what they're going to do. They're going to say, I'm the big alpha. I'm not going to be scared off. I'm not going to be intimidated. But we know that past boycotts on Bill O'Reilly were quite successful, on Glenn Beck at one point. Do you think that despite his bravado and big language that he might actually moderate his behavior and language based on this campaign against him?
I don't think so. I mean, he seems to be like sticking to it. Unless we see some pressure, like corporate pressure and outside pressure, and maybe even a little bit of internal disarray at Fox and some sort of crackdown on his language, I don't think he'll change. So people need to understand that this isn't going away, and this certainly isn't new. A lot of people, companies who sponsor him, want to act like they're surprised to learn this. He's got a well-documented history over the past couple years of saying things like this, including like explicitly mirroring language used by white nationalists and neo-Nazis. Like, this isn't new and this is not going away.
Yeah. Okay, well, I want to thank you, Jordan Yule, for your advocacy and for coming on the show today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, John.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, new polls on the Green New Deal. How convincing has this discussion over the past month been? We'll break that down after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Let's turn now to a very special topic in my heart. One of the most exciting areas of policy discussion in DC since the midterm elections has been in environmental policy, against all odds, considering the historic lack of interest that Americans and indeed every human across the planet has in those areas. But we've got this idea of the Green New Deal that has been out for a long time, but now people are actually starting to talk about it, both in DC and on the big cable news shows. And you're starting to hear rumblings around the country. What can we actually do at the federal level and at the state level to accomplish a Green New Deal? And what would it mean for different areas of policy if we did? Well, we are only weeks into an actual national conversation around this. Expect much more on that. But let's check in and see, what do the people actually think about this policy with barely any actual information being given to them yet on it? Turns out it's quite popular across all groups. Let's bring up this chart. I admit, It's very small. There's a lot of information on there, so don't expect to look at all of it. But I will say that among all registered voters, 81% of the population supports a Green New Deal. So those are registered voters, people who are politically active, likely to participate in elections, only 18% opposition. And you're seeing there amongst Democrats, even higher, 92%. but even Republicans, 64% approval for it. And in fact, in this area, as in many others, the independent support is virtually indistinguishable from the Democratic support. It doesn't really change much if you go to liberal Democrats, but it is amazing that even amongst self-identified conservative Republicans, 57% approval for this policy. In DC, that's the threshold for, oh my God, it's basically unanimous. We have to have bipartisan support. We have to pass something if we lived in a real democracy. Very high levels of support there. And you're seeing, across all areas. And look, in my intro, I admitted that people haven't heard too much about this. And there will be a discussion, there will be lies told about it, and there'll be narratives and all that. But I want to make clear to you that the description of it in the poll that I just showed you, which the Huffington Post had, is actually pretty good. And it gives quite a bit of information about what would actually be in it, which I think helps to undercut the concern that these surveys might not represent much, that people don't have much information. Well, it turns out they were given quite a bit of information. So the description in that poll before people responded was, some members of Congress are proposing a Green New Deal for the US. They say that a Green New Deal will produce jobs and strengthen America's economy by accelerating the transition from fossil fuels to clean, renewable energy. The deal would generate 100% of the nation's electricity from clean, renewable sources within the next 10 years, upgrade the nation's energy grid, buildings, and transportation infrastructure, increase energy efficiency, invest in green technology research and development, and provide training for jobs in the new green economy. How much do you support or oppose this idea? So look, there are some vague points there, but there are also specific policy goals. So 100% renewable energy inside of 10 years is far from non-specific. I mean, that is, we have to have effectively something like the Apollo project, but for renewable energy. It gives people a clear idea of the time frame that this policy would be accomplished over and an idea of what would be needed along the way. Now, to be fair, there's no reference there to actually how much it would cost, but there's also no reference to how many jobs would be produced from the new industries that would be subsidized and set up and all of that. So the economic counter argument really swings both ways from my mind, especially when you consider the huge amount of jobs that would be produced, the new economic growth that would be generated. And there's no consideration there, no mention there for the amount of damage that would be done to our economy, jobs that would be lost, let alone lives that would be lost if we don't transition to a Green New Deal, if we don't deal with climate change. And we know from both the UN report earlier this year, as well as the US government's climate report, that economic damage is going to be dire. And so some Republicans, some right-wing pundits are going to look at this and say, well, we haven't had a chance to convince people that it's too expensive, that it's some socialist fantasy. Okay, that's true, but unfortunately, you want to line up on that side. Mother Earth is on the other side. She's punching us in the face multiple times a year to the tune of many billions of dollars, and she's going to keep doing that. You are going to have an ever increasingly difficult job in trying to convince people that we should simply take that, that we should accept ever worsening extreme weather events, that we should accept, heat and drought that will lead to lower levels of food production, let alone all of the other issues. We've gone over ad nauseum on this show. But I really do think this is an amazing position to start from if you are going to not only try to convince people that we need a policy like the Green New Deal, but that you're going to organize your party's electoral future on this, which is what I want to see happen. I think over the next 2 years, in advance of the next presidential election, this should be the policy that we run on. It cuts across multiple policy areas, that is true. But this is the umbrella under which so many very necessary policy changes can coexist under. And it's one that you can definitely win elections on. I mean, what other policy, large policy that affects the economy and all of that, can you point to that has the sort of uniform support across not only Democrats and independents, but also Republicans as well, that both liberals and conservatives already support? We're going to have a conversation. It's going to get complex. It's going to get dirty and all of that. But this is an amazing starting point for that conversation. And by the way, a lot of shows will show you one poll and then say their job is done. I'm always worried you're going to think that it's an outlier or something like that. So let's go to additional support. New York Times, 98% of loyal Democrats support a Green New Deal. 96% of voters who cast ballots for President Barack Obama in 2012. But the interesting thing is 93% of voters who cast ballots for Obama, then for Trump, then supported Republicans in 2018 actually support it, which is crazy. I don't know how the number is that high, but that is very high level of support across both Democrats and Republicans. I mean, you can capture a significant portion, far more than you need to become president, by running on something like a Green New Deal. And I want to give credit to the person who helped to inject this back into the public consciousness. That is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who after that poll was revealed yesterday, tweeted, "Our first policy proposal, a Green New Deal to mobilize national jobs and infrastructure investment to address environment, fix our communities, and save the planet, has support from a majority of conservative Republican voters. Maybe that's why GOP media is so scared of us." And I think she's definitely onto something. And there was more evidence provided over the past 24 hours because she recently announced that she's going to be taking a couple of days off for self-care, and she was immediately attacked. She was attacked by Fox News, by the Daily Caller, all saying, look at this millennial taking time off. Well, first of all, it's the holidays and Donald Trump is taking a 16-day vacation. And in a world of there's a tweet for everything, he had previously tweeted out attacking Barack Obama for taking a 12-day vacation years earlier. So he's taking far more. She has been campaigning nonstop for like 2.5 years at this point, and she's not even a congresswoman yet. If she's going to take a couple of days off, I think this is the time. She can bask in the successful effort to get people to talk about and care about a Green New Deal, as now demonstrated across multiple polls. If anybody deserves a break, it's AOC at this point. And also credit to the Sunrise Movement that has helped to organize youth activists around this issue. I look forward to seeing much more from them on this topic in the next couple of years. With that said, we are going to take a break. When we come back, Donald Trump coming out of the midterms, has he gotten the message? The polls are in, and we'll break them down after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. So much to get to and what remains that we don't have much time. But I want you to get your Twitter ready because we have something that very much deserves your advocacy. We're in crunch time right now where the upcoming Democratic incoming majority in the House has to decide who is actually going to get onto different committees. Now, all committees are important. They all deal with important topics, but there are some they're sort of a higher tier in terms of being able to set priorities for things like tax policy. These are issues that affect all other issues. And it is crucial at this point that in a year where we got some of the most progressive new congressmen and women that I can remember, that they not only are in the majority, but that they're on the committees setting the sort of the stage for what the majority is actually going to do. And that is where you come in. Justice Democrats, which had amazing success over this last election in getting their candidates into office, now needs you to put pressure on the House leadership to make sure that some of those awesome progressive new leaders for us are leaders as well in that majority. So if we could bring up this graphic, you're going to see that they're calling for key appointments of progressives to important congressional committees. They're suggesting a few. I just want to spotlight some of them. Pramila Jayapal, who's been around for a bit, who's an amazing progressive congresswoman. They want her on Judiciary and Ways and Means. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ro Khanna, all three of these have been on the show. Ways and Means is a ridiculous name, but it sets tax policy for the House. If you want to pass big progressive legislation, you need big progressives on the Ways and Means Committee to make sure that we have the money to actually do it. And can you imagine a Ways and Means Committee with Khanna, Jayapal, Ocasio-Cortez? That is what we need. Now, as well, Rashida Tlaib for Appropriations, a significant other financial committee in the House. Katie Porter on Financial Services, helping provide oversight and regulation of that industry. These are all incredibly important. And you see there are different groups that are helping to push for this. You can help too. Go to justicedemocrats.com/key committees. They will help you track down the contact information of the various people that you should be contacting. You can also, by the way, tweet about this. You know, put Nancy Pelosi on there. Put the link to that website. Get more and more people to sign up because right now is where we have the potential. We have an opportunity to put pressure on the leadership and make them know that these new progressive congressmen and women, Ocasio-Cortez and all of that, are not simply going to be on some subcommittee and they're going to go off there for 2 years and accomplish nothing. No, they need to be front and center helping to set the priorities for the majority. and they're not going to get there without your advocacy. So please take a couple of moments out of your day, tweet about it, post on Instagram and Facebook about it, and go to that website, the website that we linked, and use their tool, and that'll streamline the entire thing for you. So justicedemocrats.com/key committees to make sure that these candidates that we've been fighting for are in the position to fight for you. Okay, with that, let's jump to some other news. We had the midterms. It was a gigantic wave election. Regardless of what you might have heard, it was far bigger in terms of the popular vote lead of Democratic congressional candidates than the Republicans back in the 90s in that huge wave that is always referred to as this turning point for American politics. Well, looks like we turned again, this time in a better direction. But has Donald Trump actually gotten the message? So very interesting polling data recently that tells a tale of a couple of different possible futures. So overall, we find out that Donald Trump has, in this poll from NBC News, a 43% job approval among all adults. That is shockingly high for Donald Trump, although just 38% of voters say that they would want to reelect him. That is a bizarre thing to say. I approve of his job, but I wouldn't want him to keep doing it. Whatever, fine. So between 38 and 43% of Americans are okay with Donald Trump. Now, even better news for the president, that's pretty much where Barack Obama was after his midterm drubbing, in his words. And he went on to win re-election. So does this mean Donald Trump can just coast on through to 2020 and become president again? Maybe. It is possible, but not necessarily. And there's another area of polling that I think is fascinating. That is, what do voters think about the message that was delivered to the president in the midterms? Now, both Obama and Donald Trump had horrible midterm performances. Did they actually learn from that? Now, what's interesting is just 10% of Americans say that Trump has gotten the message that voters wanted a change in direction and is making necessary adjustments to accomplish that. I think those 10% are crazy, but it's 10%, it's low. 22% say he's gotten the message, but he's not doing anything. That is not, that those people are not Trump supporters there. 33% say he didn't get the message at all. So almost no one thinks that we have said to the president strongly, we do not support the direction that you're taking the country in, change it up and maybe we'll support you. Just 1 in 10, that is a horrendous performance. Now, for comparison, 35% of voters say that Obama got the message and made the necessary changes. Now, some of them are not going to vote for him anyway. Some of them were going to vote for him regardless. You know, we're a very partisan country. But there are people who are looking to see, does the president actually respond to the will of the voters? Is he paying attention to what's going on in the country and adapting intelligently, reasonably, based on what actually happens? And on that metric, Donald Trump is doing horrendously. He is being lapped by Obama multiple times over. Now, there's some other polling data that's not really positive for Donald Trump. Americans who agree that he's being honest about the Russia probe, 34%. That means that if we assume that that 34% are the core Trump voters, he didn't even get his whole core. There are people who support him, who say he's doing a good job. Well, he's definitely lying about the Russia probe. That again is an interesting duality there. Those who believe the Russia investigation should come to an end, just 34%, which again, that is smaller than his core supporters. That means that outside of hardcore Trump supporters, virtually no one agrees with the messaging that people like him and Sean Hannity and others have been pushing for a couple of years now, that this probe is a witch hunt, it is a waste of time, it's a waste of money, and it should end. They simply don't agree with that. Now, look, I don't know how many people are going to be determining their vote in 2020 based on either that investigation or other investigations like the payments to his mistresses or the Trump Foundation or all the other ethics and legal concerns. But overall, as we go forward, there is going to be strong opposition to him, not only in the form of, you know, 70 to 100 Democrats running against him in the next primary, but there's the very real possibility that he'll be primaried as well. And normally, that would be a complete waste of time. Who is actually going to turn against their party's president to support someone else? It's probably not going to happen even now. But if it does, the fact that so many, even Republicans, don't think that he is learning anything from this, that he's willing to adapt, that means that there is an opportunity, unlike in past elections, for a primary challenger. It'll probably not come to anything, but that opportunity is actually there. Now, that said, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Alfonso Ribeira is suing a popular video game manufacturer, saying that they have falsely appropriated a dance of his and that he deserves compensation. We'll be breaking that down in a debate after this. And now it's serious debate time on the Damage Report. Welcome to the show, Brett.
Hey,
good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Let's fight.
Even though you don't seem to give a rip about what you're wearing.
You are only saying this because I said in the break that if you hadn't dressed up, I was gonna mock you, little realizing that I'm wearing a t-shirt. But you know what? I support marijuana. TYT.com/marijuana.
Slash Brett.
Have the iguana beat Brett. Anyway, let's jump
iguana
into it.
Iguana is Brett.
Okay, let's debate a little bit, okay? Let's fight.
Okay.
Alfonso Ribeiro, who famously played Carlton on The Fresh Prince, an iconic character with an iconic dance, the Carlton, now suing Epic Games, creators of Fortnite, for using his dance in the game. Let's play a little video to show you whether or not he has a point that they are taking his dance.
Yeah, there's no audio on this, but this is pretty much,
yeah.
I don't think the point
to be made. I think that's his dance.
But the point to be made isn't that, oh my gosh, well, if you look close
they
enough,
do nail it.
This is not the argument that Vanilla Ice made about Under Pressure, where he was like, bump, he added one note and is like, it's wildly different.
Yeah, they didn't add anything there.
There is no doubt this is the Carlton dance.
Yes, okay, that's
so
true.
So that's not up for debate. The question is whether this and other dances.
He really nailed it on Dancing with the Stars, by the way.
He did, but there are a lot of other dances that seem to have their origins in established works that have been published, made popular, and you know, that is not all the Fortnite dances. A lot of Fortnite dances are less popular than the Carlton dance and the other Fresh Prince dance.
We have video, right?
Yes, we do. We have a lot. So there's moments.
That's not even a dance.
So the moments we're seeing are like Jules, I think is his name. Vince from
another Fresh Prince one.
Yeah, Fresh Prince. So Pulp Fiction, Fresh Prince, Dumb and Dumber.
I didn't even realize that's what it was. Dumb and Dumber. It's a little shuffle dance.
So my legal argument as someone who has had to live in the shadows of fair use doctrine.
Yes.
Is first of all, fair use, Backpack Kid, Conor McGregor.
Wish I had that in the game.
When it gets to be a certain level of ubiquity, you're actually more protected legally in a copyright lawsuit than things that are more obscure.
Yes. Okay.
As on some, but so
and you have a mix of both of those, I think, here.
Yes.
Or some are pretty obscure. I watch Seinfeld all the time. I didn't know that that was the dance that they were taking.
Right.
So look, by the way, as we're talking about this, it's not just him. You have apparently the backpack kid who did the floss dance. He has joined into the lawsuit today. You had, a couple of other people as well.
Turk.
Forgot. Well, I don't know that he's suing, but he had previously said that they took his dance, which obviously they did. You can see the side-by-side for that as well. And there's others as well.
So what's your argument,
a couple of
John?
Rappers, too.
What do you think? Do you think that they can sue or they can't sue?
My argument has been developing. I think that's multiple people here, including Ribeiro, are attempting to copyright the dance right now. So this lawsuit is a part of that process, which mirrors other attempts to copyright things in the past. If you don't defend it, then you can't really claim that it's yours. So he has to do this.
There's like two versions of copyright due to my research, as a result of me doing the research. There's like the de facto copyright you have after having done a dance that's somewhere. That you have a copyright claim to it. Then there's the formal process of doing a copyright, like filing the paperwork, which you have to have that filed before you can do a lawsuit. With the Carlton dance, I would argue it's probably not his to copyright. I would say rather it belongs to, I forget which studio and network that was on, because typically they own everything, depending on his personal contract with
It has traveled with him.
It can have traveled with him, and there probably would be some kind of share.
So I would like to say, I've been thinking more about this, and I've been reading. So Chance the Rapper, he had tweeted previously, they should put the actual rap songs behind the dances. Black creatives created and popularized these dances, but never monetized them. And imagine if they had the money. And I am convinced, I don't know that legally they're required to pay the Floss Kid or any of the rappers or Alfonso, but I do think they should.
Whether they're making money. If their argument is fair use, they can make money off it, though it's a more difficult case to make. I do think that there's no reason for Fortnite not to share it. Yeah,
because
there's certainly
they can afford it.
Cash.
And you know, this is one of the areas where they're not responsible for it, but there is a very long history of the cultural contributions of especially Black Americans. This is not just Black artists, but there's a lot of them being appropriated and monetized, and then the origin isn't even remembered. Nobody even knows where it comes from. And there's instances of that here. Now, they're not the only video game to use these dances. Destiny and others have as well. And they're not required, I think, to pay, but I do think they should, especially if it's a kid doing the dance. Give him a scholarship.
That was his dance. He should get the money for that.
Well, thank you for joining us. Thank you for watching. We'll be back tomorrow with a lot more for you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.